Welcome to a Transmissions Podcast special event, another special event. We're back with John Barber and Andrew Griffith to talk about their upcoming new book, Cigna, which is coming very soon. I'm your host, Charles, a.k.a. Big C. I'm joined by my Transmissions co-hosts, Jeremy, a.k.a. Yakko.
Hello.
And Daryl, the Cybertronian Beast.
Hi. Let's talk Cigna.
Cool. Thanks for having me. I feel like I was giving some sort of weird hand signal. I was holding a paperclip and then started waving and realized I put a paperclip in my
hand. Well, it's great to have you back. We had you on just a couple of months ago to talk about your new project. And we promised to have you back when the Kickstarter was ready to go live. So we are fulfilling that promise right now. And
yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And thank you for we did get to take a look at an advance copy of the first issue. And I have to say, I was very impressed, excited about the story. You didn't send me issue two, though, so, you know, what's up with that? but yeah, it's so, I mean, it's a really cool introduction. Ketna is kind of a badass here, so it's she's a very interesting character. We get a little bit of her backstory just in the first issue, and what she's doing in the current present, which is the future for us. So, but yeah, it's very cool. I think I'm going to let you guys give the kind of overview, and then talk a little bit about the Kickstarter coming up and what people can expect from Cigna.
Cool.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the idea is that about 100 years ago, there was a war between humans and some renegade mining robots. And in the course of that, something happened to the sun that caused the sun to become a red giant like billions of years before it should, you know, if that were ever to happen. So now sort of the grandkids of the people that were around then are kind of realizing they're the last generation of humans. There's no like faster than light travel. Like there's no easy interstellar travel. There isn't like a warp speed that can go to and just go to another planet that's habitable somewhere. So that's, it's in this sort of hopeless world, our main character Ketna, finds a ancient mech from the war, or not ancient, but, you know, 100 years old mech from the war that, one starts kind of talking to her and comes alive, which wasn't what she was expecting. But it thinks it might have the secret to saving things. Saving humanity or saving the solar system, but for who and why? That's kind of what I boiled it down to. Andrew?
I think, you know, John summed it up pretty well. I should clarify, though, 100 years, not in our past, 100 years from when before the story takes place. So, yes. The war takes place in our future, but their past. So just to be sure.
Yeah. Fair enough. I forgot. We're in the present. I totally forgot.
It is hard to remember sometimes. I don't know. I think John summed it up pretty well. Like, I guess we can go in and you guys might have questions and stuff, but that's a good summary of kind of the general state of the things. Yeah.
Well, all right. Yeah, we'll see you guys next time. No.
Well, yeah. So what are your I know you have a six issue like first story arc planned out. Do you have kind of a longer vision for where you want to take this story? At the end of the six issues, I imagine all the problems are not going to be solved and the sun is not going to be back to normal and everything's going to be hunky dory. So how big of an epic do you envision this this sci-fi tale to be?
Well, we definitely do. I mean, we have like a start point and an end point in mind for six issues, then also for a larger story if we have the opportunity to tell that story, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like we have, it could get really big and it could get really epic, or it could also be constrained to them trying to overcome, like John said, this hopeless situation where the world's and the solar system and everything is going to end because the sun's going to consume everything. So it's like, is there anything that can be done about that? But then I don't know. I don't want to like spoil too much, but of course the more people buy the book, the more people are interested in the book, the more we'll be justified to tell the rest of the story that we want to tell, you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can make it an epic. No, yeah, we definitely, we have more that we want to do with these characters after the first story. I think originally I think you always did, Andrew. And then I kind of originally kind of came in with like, why don't we do this whole story here? And you pointed out it was very rushed. The idea wasn't gelling. And I think kind of pulling it back and telling a more contained story with the characters in this universe was the way to go.
I think like originally we had it all wrapping up nice and neat in six issues, and then
it actually wasn't neat. It was very bleak.
But no, over time, you know, we just kept having more and more ideas, and mm-hmm. we'd brainstorm things back and forth, and I was like, why don't we expand this a bit, you know, and like, there's so much we can do here and so many ideas that we have. Why don't we add in these extra layers of depth and give ourselves a little more breathing room, mm-hmm. you know, that we can really make the most of this.
So. And I guess you could also like future ideas could be like going in backstories of some of the different characters. Cause one of the things I really liked about it was you're jumping in the first panel and you got this banter between everyone. And it seems like you're just jumping in the middle of something that's been happening. And I always worry when I'm reading something brand new, you know, getting familiar with the characters or just kind of invested in them. And it just kind of happened right away with this.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, that was John scripting, by the way.
Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. That was a joke.
I did get quite invested because we actually lose a couple of characters pretty quickly in the first issue, and
yes, there are stakes. That's right, there are stakes. Yes.
but just the little time I had with those characters, they were pretty endearing. So you know, it was a little bit sad to see them go so quickly. But that shows that there are stakes. There are there are consequences. So this is not a, this is a story that where, you know, things can happen. So.
Well, I think that's indicative too of like how we work together, because for a long time we kind of, you know, shot back and forth different ideas of what the story was going to be and the broad strokes of the plot. And, you know, we both contributed ideas about where it was going and different plot elements and different twists we could have and things. But then like once all that was planned out, John went away and pretty much wrote a script, you know, and then he came back and I knew there was going to be a main cast of characters, but he, you know, gave them names and personalities. And it was like a whole bit of a surprise for me when I saw the script of like, oh, this is cool. Like he put so much individuality into the characters mm-hmm. and the setting and everything that the specifics of it that I hadn't necessarily envisioned, you know? So then when I drew it, I got to put my side on it, you know, like come up with the characters. Like it was a nice co-creation of the characters and everything.
Yeah. And then likewise, like once you got the visuals, you know, once I saw what they looked like, you know, cause I really didn't have that much in my head on them. Like that made, so we actually did a plot first and then Andrew drew it. And then I came back into the dialogue afterwards. And, seeing them come to life like that, it was like, oh, all these people aren't, you know, they suggested more of their personality through the visuals as well. So, yeah, I think that idea of like, you know, dropping in the middle of it and not going in and over explaining everything is appealing to both of us. I mean, I think we, like early on, I mean, not this is like a huge surprise given the two of us, like, you know, Transformers is obviously a thing that we were thinking about, and so is Star Wars. I think early on, you know, because this is like gestating for a long time, this story, it was, you know, kind of more directly Star Wars-y. But this is, I mean, this is going back to, I mean, I think we, I don't remember if we talked about it last time we were on here, but there was a version of the story that was very close to like what the Mandalorian show wound up being. This is how far back this goes that we were talking about it before then. It was like, you know, that time period after the Empire fell, and it would have been chaos. They haven't really done very much in that time period in Star Wars, said we back then. And like, that's totally, you know, and this is a completely different version of the story that we've got now. Like that's very different. But like this, one of the things that I think probably remained that I think both of us liked was, you know, we both grew up as the original Star Wars movies were coming out, and you didn't know everything about every character then. And it was all question marks, and it's not anymore. And it's still cool. You know, I still like Star Wars stuff, but I know there's a Wikipedia entry on every background character in there. I know I can find like, you know, 60,000 words on Max Rebo's legs or lack thereof. And, you know, and like when we were kids, it was just like, oh, who's that blue guy? You know, you just knew him from the name of the toy, and that was it, you know, there's something really fun about that, about jumping in there and just, and not knowing what that stuff is. But we've got a really detailed like roadmap for how things got to where they are. And I don't know that we'll ever see some of that. Like some of the stuff I think we're better off just never talking about probably. But some of the stuff definitely, I mean, we need to know it to understand how the world works.
Right.
And as the story progresses, some of that will be revealed, of course.
Yeah,
right. But unveiled, and it was very much like, you know, the opening scene of the original Star Wars. You're just jumped into this battle, and you're like, "What's going on?" And here, you know, you're like, "This crew is just kind of in the middle of something," and you're learning as they go along, and it's just slowly coming to light what's going on. And I really enjoy stories that are revealed like that, rather than like the old style comics that were like, "Hi, I'm, you know, this name," and right, you go through the entire cast in like the first two panels.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I'm thinking like, of the like Marvel Transformers number one.
Exactly. Right.
When they all go through and introduce themselves. Yeah. But this was actually structured a lot more like cinematically, like when you watch a movie, especially like a Bond movie or something, where you have this long extended action sequence that introduces you to the characters and the current setting and scenario and everything, and starts to set up the plot a little bit and gets you thrown into the world like right away. So that's kind of what we were structuring it around, I think.
Well, I got a very Guardians of the Galaxy number one feel out of it. Right. Oh. The movie starts with Star-Lord kind of going, doing his thing. Right. And then kind of all hell breaks loose and, you know, you go from there. So I got a real Guardians of the Galaxy number one feel from that.
You know what? That was not in my head, at least. That wasn't in my head, at least, but I see it. Yeah.
Well, I'm much less of a Star Wars nerd than Jeremy is. And, and obviously you guys. So, I've seen the movies and I enjoy them, but I am not a Wikipedia member.
Yeah, he's not as cultured.
Yeah. Funny, also, right.
Like we talk about Star Wars a lot as a touching point and stuff. And like, but the structure I'm talking about, like the first issue, I wasn't even thinking so much of like Star Wars. I mean, some of the movies start out with a long action sequence like that, but I was thinking more of like Bond or like other action movies, you know, that have like a long establishing action sequence.
Yeah. I was actually, one of the ones I was thinking of was Ultimates issue one. I don't remember whether we talked about that a little bit, but just like where it was just an all the big, yeah.
Read that one when it came out.
It was like an extended World War II, you know, like Captain America sequence, and that isn't really what we have here. But like, just that idea that we like, there's a lot of action in the first issue, but I think it's a lot of action that kind of pushes the, you know, hopefully pushes the characters forward, and the characters have to make decisions in that action and stuff. It isn't just, you know, like I don't think either of us are really interested in just fighting for the sake of fighting, you know, a bunch of smashing stuff.
I did really like the battle scene was in in addition to being, you know, kind of, you know, rock 'em sock 'em robots, but also having that, like, showing the intelligence of the main character and how she, like, overcomes the obstacle in, you know, in the story, and how it's, like, set up ahead of time about, like, you know, did you get the right upgrade for your suit? Did you, you know, and it's like, it was really, I thought that was a really kind of cool way to demonstrate her intelligence and then her resourcefulness and then, you know, how that all played out. So,
Yeah, I think you really helped keep us on track on that one, Andrew, because I think there were some parts where we were kind of, I was kind of getting.
Well, it was important to me, like, to make sure that she wasn't too naive, also wasn't, like, too experienced. And, like, you didn't want, like, a Mary Sue kind of character, but you wanted somebody who obviously showed some type of talent to be doing what she's doing. And so I think a lot of that comes from, like, she's a resourceful character. She's not the most experienced. She's not the most, like, worldly, but she's got, like, a resourceful kind of make it up she goes along kind of way about her that lets her get through these situations. And I didn't want her to be incapable or, like, having to rely on other people too much, you know?
Yeah, but she does mention, you know, I first thing I learned from this character was to do this. And, you know, so it gives a basis to kind of some of her knowledge level. She's learning from everybody and she's taking what they're saying and incorporating it.
Well, she has common sense.
Right.
That's the main thing that I got.
But she's also to be, like, knowledgeable and eager to learn.
Mm-hmm. Right. But she's also got, like, a bit of a, I don't know, what would you say, John, like a guarded way to her, or like a, not a chip on her shoulder, but a bit of like a, I don't know.
Skepticism
about the world and like a bit of a, there's a word I'm looking for. I can't think of it right now, but.
Oh, you know, trauma. I mean, she's got a lot of trauma going on here from her youth.
Yeah.
When you see that, but yeah, she, in addition to having her be, like, capable and good at all that stuff, I also did want to have her, like, be affected by the stuff that goes on. Yeah. And I think, you know, you sort of see that a little bit where she's, like, she just, like, starts working on stuff in her workshop. It isn't a normal, like, a, you know, quote-unquote normal time to do that kind of thing. But, like, that's how she focuses and that's how she gets through the stuff. And, not that I think Star Wars was the only thing that we were looking at. I was, like, really trying to, you know, not be like, all we're doing is, you know, there's both kinds of science fiction, Star Wars and Star Trek.
There's Alien too.
That's right. I forgot about the third one. No, but, like, you know, like, I read a lot of science fiction.
Novels true.
Stuff. I like to keep up on stuff, you know, but there was a moment in the, was it the Force Awakens, where you have, like, Rey have a moment after she, like, blasts a stormtrooper. And, I did want to have a little bit of something like that, because I always felt like in Star Wars, when's the first time Luke Skywalker kills a guy? Like, it's not even a moment in the movie. And he's this farmer and he kills a bunch of people. Like, he kills a lot of people. And doesn't that at some level, don't you, if you've never done that and all of a sudden you start doing that?
Well, to be fair, he saw his aunt and uncle burn to corpses.
Oh, no, he's justified. So. He's justified, but that's still got to be like, oh, I just, I just pulled a
string
and made somebody not be alive anymore. And
Star Wars does not treat the stormtroopers like human beings at all. So it's like if they had
faces, they would be different.
Exactly. I think that was a large reason why they designed them the way they did, so they'd be faceless evil entities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
and why they're like stormtroopers. Like, that's, you know, it kind of gives you a clue.
Yeah.
No, they're the bad guys. Like, that's a bad guy.
Yeah.
They're bad. Yeah.
No, but are we, like, the baddies?
Yeah, right. Are we the baddies? we intentionally though didn't want to, like, hew too closely to, like, something specific like Star Wars or something. Yeah. Like, Star Wars definitely influenced my look for the book. I really wanted it to be like a lived-in universe, but that also came just from the reality and the context of the story, you know. So, like, But in terms of like the story, I don't think it's too Star Wars-y. There's definitely some similarities and things, but I think there's also elements of like, you know, Star Trek or other post-apocalyptic kind of sci-fi settings or something like Mad Max or something like that. You know, there's a lot of different things that you know, we have similarities to. And
yeah. I can see Mad Max for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I did not get a, like, this is a Star Wars copy or homage or anything from this story. Like, this felt pretty like a unique kind of, you know, post-apocalyptic sci-fi world with a specific reason why it's post-apocalyptic, and then there's breadcrumbs as to telling you a little bit of what's going on, but you know, it's the first issue, so you don't get a whole lot of information, but you get enough to say there's a hook here of something interesting. But you know, it's pretty different from you know, I mean, I would say a closer parallel might be something like Terminator. I mean, you reference Terminator directly in the story, when I think Ketna says the world was Skynetted or something. Yeah.
I sort of made the guess that like maybe people, you know, a couple hundred years from now would still know what Terminator was, especially if something vaguely analogous happened, you know. Yeah. But it wasn't. Yeah, I mean, it was a different situation than that. But yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd read the book yet, but I'd The Expanse was kind of an influence on me and parts of it, especially once I got further into the story, The Expanse just sort of mainstreamed hard science fiction in such a way that there's, you know, a lot of things that it thinks about that I think once you dig into that, it's hard not to think about those things, you know, acceleration and, you know, like just like even on that level, but also just the societal impulse to move throughout the galaxy or throughout the solar system. Martha Wells' Murderbot books, like those, I really enjoy those, and that is not where like Cigna comes from, you know, Cigna is not a assassin robot turned main character, but that sort of approach to the way she writes the artificial intelligence part of it, or like, you know, a mechanical intelligence, like that was a big influence on me, or a big thing I liked, or I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I've.
Yeah. We talk a lot about like how you know. We want to gear this more towards like a hard sci-fi rather than like space fantasy, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's still a bit of hand waving, but we always try to keep in mind like, well, would there be gravity here? Or how is the inertia going to affect the way people are affected in the ship and things like that? And how, you know, how much of the sun's light's going to affect you when you're this far out from it and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You mentioned magnet shoes, or like activating magnets on the shoes, and that kind of tells you right there, okay, no anti-gravity.
Right. We try to throw those kind of things in there. Yeah. Personally, I feel like the closest thing we have to like some kind of fantasy element so far is, to me, the Cigna thing, the way, kind of like the origin of it, as you'll see in the book and how it comes about. It's almost like a one-of-a-kind kind of living AI sort of thing, or at least it behaves that way. So I think that's an interesting element to a unique element to our book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We definitely, it doesn't take months to go between places where it would in real life almost definitely have to take months to go between. So you kind of like, okay, they've, you know, even the Expanse had to do that. Like, oh, they've got a way to go faster than, you know, efficiently faster than you should be able to.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, 200 years ago, who would have thought we'd have the stuff that we have now? So that's hand wavy, but also some of it's like,
justify it, you know?
I mean, we went from the first airplane to landing on the moon in less than 100 years. So
yeah, right.
You know, things can advance.
Yeah.
Andrew, do you want to touch on the design of the ship that they use? Because I noticed in the book it was – I think it was one panel, but I noticed it where the ship kind of has a dock in and of itself. It docks with itself to go in, I'm assuming, much further into deeper space. But they've got smaller component to kind of go into the planet.
Well, that was kind of part of it. I mean, that was intentional, where like the main part where like there's the cockpit and like the essential, I don't know, services or whatever you call it of the ship, like controlling the ship could be like a drop ship where you can actually go down into atmosphere and stuff. While the modular components that they leave up in space orbiting wouldn't be as aerodynamic, because we don't have like that magical spaceship that can fly in any atmosphere like a Star Wars or something. You know what I mean? We don't have like the anti-gravity that would let you fly into a atmosphere, even though you don't have the aerodynamics for it. So I wanted a ship that could at least, like I said a few minutes ago, at least like you could rationalize a way that it would be feasible. So I tried to design it in a way, and eventually we'll post the concept art, but I did a lot of concept art about like, you know, where the lift could come from and like where the thrust would be directed to help increase that lift and things like that, and give it some sort of at least explanation for the aerodynamics. So that main part is the part that they use to go in and out of planets or moons or asteroids or whatever, while the living quarters and the storage and the cargo and stuff that they don't need stays up in orbit, you know? So I was going for, you know, practicality over design, you know? So I was trying to think about how it could practically work and make something interesting and something that we haven't quite seen before. And in my mind, it did have a role in the past as humans explored the solar system, where we haven't gone in and explained this yet, and this could change. But in my mind, it was some sort of like long distance, like transport through space, maybe from Earth out to Jupiter or Mars or something. It would go back and forth, and it was like a progression of the current, you know, spaceship kind of traveling capabilities that we have. So that's kind of where my head was at.
That's what I assumed that it was, essentially, is that they, you know, the main body that stayed in orbit was used for the main component of the fuel was up there, right? And the rest of the storage was up there, and everything else that was unnecessary for, you know, the missions that would be up and down and, you know, from the main dock to the planet and whatever, that would just stay in orbit. And that's right. Essentially what, yeah. So that's, and then it being a larger vessel, being capable of traveling much longer distances. So,
right. Yeah. So like in the larger modular parts, and I did figure it would be modular, that if we wanted to, we could change and add sections as needed, as the plot would need, if we want to and stuff. But I figured that's where like the living quarters would be and stuff. They don't need to be to take their bedroom along down to Earth to try to steal some components or whatever, you know?
Right. So
that's kind of how I pictured it.
Cool. Yeah.
Awesome. So now the Kickstarter is, as I think we'll release this either the day before or the day the Kickstarter goes live. So maybe, I don't know if you have all the details worked out at this point, but like what's going to be, what kinds of goodies are you offering in the Kickstarter? Do you have any high level tiers for people who want to back this thing?
Sean, you might be better with that.
Okay. So, what are we going to have? We're going to have the high level stuff. I think Andrew will do sketches, right? We've got some remark editions. We've got some cool extra covers. We've got Andrew's main cover. We've got a cover by. You might have heard of these guys, Alex Milne and Josh Perez, our old friends, Alex and Josh, were kind enough to do a cover for us. Chrissy Zulo did a really cool cover with really highlights our dog character who doesn't appear in issue one except on the covers, but the dog will be there soon.
I have a question about that, although we'll touch on that after.
Sounds good. And then Tom Scioli did a cover for us as well, and we have a 3D version of Tom's cover, like just here, like real old school red and blue 3D glasses.
Now you just look like the kid from Back to the Future.
I can't go wrong with that. I'm just going to, no. Oh, man, that is so awful. All right. I'm staring like right into a light when I do that. And that is not fun. Everything's blue. Everything's red.
I feel like there's
got some postcards. I think
postcards, some art cards, some sketches that I'll do, remarks. I feel like there's one or two things that we weren't quite solid on yet, if we're doing or not. Or is that settled already?
No, I don't think there's. I don't think everything's. I don't know anything that you don't. Okay. Like there's no secret that I know.
Everyone check out the Kickstarter.
Yeah, I'll find out what's on there when the Kickstarter launches. Like, people always ask, when's this issue coming out? I'm like, I don't know. Ask someone who knows.
Well, let me ask you about the dog character. It's on the cover. It does not appear in issue one. You guys have a history of introducing dog characters into your comics. You gotta tell me something from my heart here. Does anything happen to the dog?
You haven't even met it yet.
I know, but I've seen the picture and I need to know.
Well, there are one or two characters on the cover who haven't shown up yet. And that covers.
I only care about the dog.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. it will be showing up within the first six issues. And, as of now, we don't have any plans to do anything horrible to it, do we?
I'm not killing the dog. No.
Thank God.
The dog might be the only one standing at the end, but I'm not going to kill the dog.
Fantastic.
Kill as many humans as you want. Just leave the dog alone.
Yeah.
The dog will
figure out how to pilot the mech and just go off and...
can we edit that part out? I don't want to give that away.
Is the dog based on any real pet?
Actually, yeah. So when we did Transformers, the dog was based on John's late dog, Charlie. And this time... Oh, yeah, exactly. And then this time it's based on a dog of mine that passed away a couple of years ago, a young dog named Marco. So he looks like a scrappier version of my dog that passed away.
It's a great way to honor those dogs. It's to immortalize them in these comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It might be a little hard to like look at reference and stuff, but some way to keep them alive a little bit.
No, that's great. I'm glad you guys are doing that. Yeah. I'm so much looking forward to meeting the dog character now.
Since I know you don't have anti-gravity, just looking forward to seeing like a dog just floating by.
Yeah. They have leash laws. They're a little different though. You just gotta keep them pinned down.
It's like a balloon. It's like
a dog balloon.
It's like those it's like the fake zeros you can buy at Disneyland where they've got like the metal the metal dog, like you're walking an invisible dog. Except you got a real dog on it.
But no, I mean we were kind of known for having Buster and everything and Thundercracker and all that in the Transformers comics, so it's like we might as well go with what we know people like that we can do. We know we can do it, ride a dog.
Yeah. I don't know. Is it even that cynical? We just like having dogs.
I think it does offer a little bit of hope for a dystopian future that at least, there are still dogs and humans still kind of, have a relationship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing I'm excited about, and I've talked to John a few times, I want to make sure too that like, as we explore our solar system, like to see what life is out there and what forms of life there might be through like genetic manipulation and things like that, or like what types of animals have survived, or what we might discover later on under a block of ice, on a moon or something. I want to have the freedom to explore that kind of stuff where it fits too. I want to explore a little bit, I want to be able to have some wonder, have some surprises and things. So as we go on, hopefully we'll have some time to catch our breath and see some of that stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, for those watching who may not, I mean, I hope people know this, but if you don't know this, John and Andrew collaborated on several issues of Transformers for IDW back in the day. So, I mean, it was like the 57 issues of Transformers, Robots in Disguise, and then Transformers, and then like 25 issues of Optimus Prime, I think. And then Unicron. And
Transformers ended at 55, right?
55.
And okay. I wasn't on every issue, but I think that series stopped at 55, I think.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, but I definitely like that one was...
Salvation, we did Bumblebee.
You guys made a lot of comics.
Yeah.
At some point, you can stop counting.
And I'm reminded when people... I'm sorry. Well,
no, go ahead. Finish your point.
I'm reminded of that when people come to conventions with a stack, you know, this high of comics to sign.
Daryl.
So it's like, wow, I worked on a lot of comics. And those are all like... It's not like those are multiple covers of the same issue. Those are like one issue, you know, a piece.
Yeah, I saw you tweet recently about people that are discovering it for the first time now.
Yeah,
I've had this year, I feel like more than recent years, I've had people come up to me, like at Emerald City, this young fan, she came up and she said she flew to that show because she saw I was going to be there because she had recently discovered Robots in Disguise on Tumblr. And I'm assuming she'll read More Than Meets the Eye and everything too, but she seemed really into RID. And then a few minutes later, I had like this older gentleman come up who had just gotten into Transformers and stuff, and he was really into it. And then like someone about right in the middle of those ages came up a little bit later. And then I was at another show the next weekend. It was the same kind of thing where people were coming up to me who were just recently getting into those comics or rediscovering them, you know? So it's really nice that still survives.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of cool to see, like, I mean, they're putting out, McFarlane's putting out those, the toys.
Yeah,
the comics. Oh, the page punchers.
Yeah, page punchers. Yeah, yeah. I've been fiddling around with my Batman, one of those, my Dark Knight Returns, one of those, while I've been talking.
Yeah.
But, it's cool to see, you know, Andrew's cover out there again on, with Wheeljack, the one behind you. Yeah.
Right there. It's one of the few early ones I still have.
Yeah. Nice. I think there's also Optimus Prime one as well.
Yeah. Was that when your design, Andrew?
The first issue, so whatever, whichever one, whoever did that
first. It was the cover for the first issue.
That was Kay's illustration, right, of my design before it switched to the Evergreen one.
So it's cool to see that stuff still coming out somewhere. And
Hopefully they do make it more available now because there's no easy way to get those old books at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I was at the Comic-Con panel when they were talking about when Robert Kirkman was getting all the questions I used to get about Transformers, because a lot of the same fans, were there, and that's awesome. But like, I'm sure at some point they'll reprint that stuff. Yeah. I totally understand them wanting to make their own version, the one that you're getting, and not dump out a bunch of material, especially a bunch of material that, even though it's not as super easy to get, isn't the hardest thing in the world to get. You know, they're not in print, but you can buy them on eBay, and I don't think they're going for thousands of dollars or anything. So I totally get it, but I am excited for the day when they do come back in, and that'd be cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I still am disappointed we never got IDW collections of the whole run that we ran out of IDW ran out of license before it got to the end of the
run.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing I've been hearing about is like how expensive some of those trades are getting to be. So I have some long boxes and stuff of like some comps and trades. I got to go look and see what I still have.
Yeah.
Yep. So what, were there any lessons you took away from your time on Transformers in terms of just kind of long form comic storytelling and you know, how, cause you know, you spent a lot of time building up a lot of stories. I mean, you had to mine a lot of content that came before you. And so you came in kind of in the middle of the story and then kind of made it your own. Were there any lessons that you took away from building that kind of continuity.
No, I really didn't. I was trying not to pay attention. I'm sorry. No, I don't know. I'm trying to think. The funniest thing when I originally pitched this series, I'm sure I've told this story before, but I had a 12 issue outline, and then I was like, you know what? I'm going to make it 13 and see if I can get another paycheck out of it. Okay, let's go for 13. Let's see if I can do 13. That'd be good. And then once the series came out, it became apparent we weren't going to get canceled right away. There was always, it's comic book, so that was always a danger. At a certain point it came up because I think we launched and then New 52 came out right after that. And there were definitely, I don't know if I've ever said this to anybody. There were discussions of maybe we should just cancel Transformers and do a New 52 type thing and just start over with a new number one and a whole new universe. And I was like, well, let's see how these first issues go. And then they sold out and went back to press. If we'd been selling, if we got rid of us and got Daniel Warren Johnson and got those numbers, maybe that would have been better. I don't know.
I used to be really happy that the G.I. Joe issues I did sold out. I was like, wow, yeah, that's really impressive. And then now, anyway.
He came with a built-in audience. But
yeah,
just get anything he buys.
The whole relaunch is a big excitement. But
sure.
Anyway, I don't know. I talked a lot to James, especially because both of us were aware that, in terms of writing the stuff, that we were coming in and getting in a unique position where our first ongoing series wasn't just a
James Roberts show. For anyone listening.
Yeah. Sorry, James Roberts.
He doesn't know who he is.
Yeah. you never have that. You know what I mean? We got so lucky to have this long form space available to us with a minimum of interference compared to the way those things usually go anywhere. We had crossovers and stuff, but they were our own at least. It wasn't like an event in, Ninja Turtles didn't cause us to have to go do something. That's a great comic, but that wasn't, we weren't relying on other stuff. I don't know. I don't know if that situation presents itself again. So I don't know at this point, what lesson do I learn from that? I liked that part of kind of knowing where we're going, but not having everything nailed down. And then as we move on, new things suggest themselves and things kind of change. But still kind of heading toward that same goal. I learned everything from working on Transformers, but I think one thing I don't want to lose sight of is don't make it where the really good issue is issue 25. You know what I mean? Issue one has to be really good, and then issue two has to be better, and then issue three has to be better. And you can coast on issue four, but issue five should be good.
John's learned how to put up me too. He's spent enough years with me where I can contribute a new idea and he'll be like, ah, damn it. And then he'll think about it and be a bit and be okay. Maybe that's not so bad,
But
at least that's how he's described it. But
there's a bunch of, you can go back to Transformers. I want to make some new characters. And that's where Aileron came from. And that was, she was one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really rewarding to see how much the fans took to her and other characters like that. Yeah.
I definitely agree with your sentiment about making each issue have something impactful in it. I think that we've reviewed other comics on our show where that's been kind of a central complaint is that the story there's a little bit interesting in each issue, but each issue doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end that tells a single story. You're supposed to, it's a serialized story, but each book should have a, you know, if not self-contained, at least, you know, a story that has some resolution in the book before you move on to the next thing. And that's something I definitely think we appreciated that in Robots in Disguise and More Than Meets the Eye, that each issue had, you know, had a story that resolved itself while still adding to the continuing narrative. And yeah, I think that's something that needs to be kept in the forefront for writing comics and drawing comics. So,
and one thing that, like, I'll point out, at least I want to point out, like, is if people liked what we did on Robots in Disguise and what we put into it, the themes and the sort of art and the detail and, like, John's world building skills and all that kind of stuff, like, a lot of what we learned and practiced on R&D, we're kind of honing on Cigna. You know, we're putting throwing all that into Cigna 100%. I think if people liked what we did then, I think they'll really like what we're doing now. So even if they're hesitant to dive into characters they don't know, I think they'll appreciate it if they give it a chance. Because a lot of similarities.
I'm sure that when we get to issue 6, we'll find something and then go back to issue 1 and see where that was set up. And we just, you know, completely, it passed us by in that first issue.
Oh, wait, let me write that down. What was that? There's definitely things being set up that I think, fingers crossed, will pay off really well later.
Yeah, I think you guys have definitely kept a, from the sounds of it, with Transformers, you had this this overarching narrative that you wanted to tell, but you always had the sight set on how you wanted to end it, how the ending kind of, you know, was going to work, and the middle was very fluid, and you kind of worked with that, which is something from the sounds of it, you're working with Cigna as well, is you know how you want to end, but you're dealing with, well, how long is the series going to be? And we're going to work with that. And it's all the very, very fluid dynamics in the middle. I mean, and that's very cool. And I love that. In my mind, you guys have a definite ending. You may not even realize, I'm sure you do. Your son goes supernova and it's over. Cut to black.
But somehow dog survives.
Okay. It's just a dog just floating out with a space helmet on. Yep, and exactly. Yeah.
Floats by the
end of 2001, but a dog in the bubble instead of the baby.
Yeah. Yeah. But
the end of the second Planet of the Apes movie, that this insignificant planet is now dead. That was the end.
Spoiler.
They'll go to a different world and then the Statue of Liberty will be a dog.
Yeah.
So it'll be dogs riding horses.
I still can't figure out the ending of that Tim Burton Planet of the Apes, but
was another one?
It was Tim Burton, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's been so long. Okay.
Yeah, that was like 2000, wasn't it? Yeah.
Somewhere around there. Yeah.
Yeah, Mark Wahlberg was in there.
Yep. Yep.
Oh man, I forgot about that. Huh.
The crazy thing is they keep making new Planet of the Apes movies and they just come out. It's like there's no fanfare or anything. They're just out. And it's like, oh, it's another one. And then it's gone. I'm like, wasn't there a planet? Yeah, there's been like 17 Planet of the Apes movies and they're all been out and they're all great. And then, but nobody knows about them. So
Andy Serkis needs to work and he can't do every role in Star Wars. You know? Right.
Well, there is a new one this summer.
Darryl. Yeah, there is there?
Of course there is. It's one every 6 months.
Mm-hmm. They're like Fast and the Furious movies.
That's right.
So one thing I'm curious about from your creator perspective, I know like the page count for comics has been shrinking a little bit. Like I think it was in the middle of the IDW Transformers era where you went from 22 pages down to 20, and now that's the industry standard is 20 pages per comic. So I was wondering, like, from your perspective, does that make it harder or easier to like, do you feel like that's too tight for having a story in a single comic? Do you miss those 2 pages, or do you think even like, should we go back to like the 80s with like, I don't know, 20, 23, 24, 25 pages? What
do you have to follow the industry standard when you're making a Kickstarter comic?
This issue is, what is it? It's 30 pages.
34, I think.
What, 32 or something? Or,
yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. We added more at the end. I forgot. Yeah, it is. That's right. It's 30. Yeah.
It's over 30.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is a deluxe issue, so
yeah.
It won't all be this size.
Right.
Yeah.
I think issue 2 is, what, 20 pages?
That's what that's what we've been going on. I mean, like, theoretically, we've got the ability to kind of add more pages if we need it. I miss those pages. I mean, I like to make jokes about, you know, the writing being much easier and stuff. And it is, right? Like, it's definitely harder to be Andrew than it is to type some dialogue and then, whatever. especially in this book where it's like everything has to get designed, you know, where every door, every shoe, every, I don't know, are there other things? Doors and shoes. but like every, you know, like everything has to get figured out. There's nothing you can go to and be like, this is what we use or whatever. Like, that's super hard. And then actually drawing it and then all the acting and everything. But, I do think it's harder to write a 20 page comic book than it is to write a 22 page comic book. And that is the one part where I will complain on the writer's side that like writers got screwed, I think, when that happened, because we got paid less per issue and it was more difficult to write them, you know, 'cause you're still kind of trying to get the same amount of stuff in there mostly. And it was nice to have a couple pages and then you don't have them anymore. So at least that's my perspective on it. And then I think artists would just get, when jerks like me, like make 7-panel pages with, a million characters in each one or something, then that's when we just kick that over to the artist and make it harder on them. But I don't know. It's all, you know, honestly, when I first started in comics, like right when I first started working at Marvel, and it was like everything was based on a page, you know, like how fast is the artist? Oh, they draw, you know, 3.45 pages a week or something, you know, like a David Bogart used to have a spreadsheet that would list all that. I'm sure it's a little more professional now. And I remember like thinking like, man, that's not how it works. Like some pages are super easy and some are super hard, you know, but I guess, okay, how else do you divide it down? You know, do you pay artists because the page is easier? Do they get paid less? Do they get paid more for hard pages? You know, okay. Now I guess you have this basic unit, but, it's interesting where I think non-mainstream, non-20-page comics have kind of gone to a system where that isn't necessarily the case. Like it might be here. I think you get like, here's your amount of money for a graphic novel and it's around, you know, 120 pages. But if it's 128, okay, you're not getting paid for those eight extra pages, but you know, whatever.
All great.
But it might not actually be harder to do those eight extra pages either. You know what I mean? Like it's harder to jam all that stuff into the other space.
Well, one thing for me is like just those 2 pages less a month. It's surprising. It makes it a lot easier to meet like a monthly page, you know, a monthly, sustain a monthly book working on it. At least you can do more issues until you need fill-in artists and stuff. Yeah. It's funny how it does make a big difference. Just those 2 pages. And maybe that's because it's condensed more. So you have less like splash pages and things like that. But, I don't know, but it does seem to move things a little quicker as an artist. It makes it easier to feel like you're going to get to that goal, you know, because a lot of times when you're 4 or 5 pages in, it feels like it's like, wow, I'm never going to get to the end of this book. But it makes it feel a little more attainable, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't really affect your pay because by the time you're done with that, you're starting the next issue. So,
yeah. Yeah, that's exactly. It didn't impact artists the same way because the artists were usually drawing the most they could possibly draw anyway. You know, like it impacts you if you're getting hired for a one shot somewhere, but it doesn't impact you if you were like the ongoing artist on something.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And speaking of which, I always tried not to lose sight of how rare it was that we had the opportunity to do Robots in Disguise and stuff. And like, how often does it happen anymore? We have a creative team working together for that long on one continuous story. You know, it's just that was a pretty unique opportunity that we had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, man. That was great.
Yeah. I don't think
it's even better now.
Who's anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, look at Daniel Warren Johnson just fired his artist on Transformers, and you know, issue 7 is going to have a whole new artist.
Finally.
Like, that was a similar thing for me too when I worked on G.I. Joe. It's just so, it's still weird to me that, like, I got to draw on the continuity that started when I was a kid, that I, one of the first comics I read as a kid, and it's still the same continuity that, like, I got to, you know, take part in, and I never would have imagined that as an 8-year-old or whatever, you know. So yeah. I've had some really good opportunities in this industry, and but probably the one I've been most excited about, and this is honest and not just because it's right now, is Cigna. You know, I've been wanting to do like a creator-owned original thing for a really long time, and it's just nice to work with John again, and I think we work really well together, and I think that shows, I hope. So it's definitely something that we're excited about, and I want to see
a transition. That was an amazing transition, Andrew. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Wonderful. I had that right.
Well, I mean,
it does show. You guys have done good work here. I think you guys should be proud of it.
Well, thanks. We've been getting good feedback, wouldn't you say, John? I mean, from the people we've shown it to.
Yeah. No, it's been nice to. It's been nice to be able to show somebody an actual issue and hear back from people. So that's been. I feel like we've been working on it for so long, and I feel like I had like 5 pages on my iPad for so long that I could show people at conventions or something, and you know, go, ooh, that looks nice. Yeah. Wait till you read it.
I don't know if we mentioned this last time, but we actually did like a 5-page pitch like five or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's something that might get seen at some point too. But it was a whole different thing then. It was more intergalactic, but aliens and things. But it's something we've been working on, and I'd love to find like the first time we talked about this on an email or something, probably 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great way to end this interview. So thanks to John Barber and Andrew Griffith for coming on Transmissions, talking to us about Cigna, and everyone check out the Kickstarter, which should be launching as soon as you're watching this. We'll have a link in the show notes so you can get to it directly there, and definitely back this. I'm going to back this and I want to see this happen. Yeah. I need issue 2, so I got to back it so I can get issue 2. So
awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for talking to us. And and we'll be definitely happy to have you back when the Kickstarter is successful and we can announce the release date of the first issue and everything, and have a celebration. We'll be happy to have you back on to talk about it.
Oh man, love to. Thanks. Thanks for having us. Yeah, it's great to be here. Yeah, good to see all you guys again.
No, it's good to see you guys.
All right, everyone. Thanks for watching this special episode of Transmissions. Everyone check out Cigna and check out John Barber and Andrew Griffith. We'll put all their social media contacts in the show notes too. So you can go harass them. Don't harass them, but you can contact them and say hi. Check out that. And if you're interested in listening to a podcast, you can check out Transmissions. We do 2 podcasts every week about Transformers toys and Transformers media. We review the Transformers comics. We reviewed IDW comics for a long time. Now we're reviewing the Skybound comics as well.
We're making Daryl review G.I. Joe comics.
that's a guilty pleasure, making him suffer. And of course, we talk all about Transformers toys as well. It's the 40th anniversary of Transformers, so there's lots of awesome stuff coming out this year for that. Check all that out at transmissionspodcast.com. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Transmissions. If you'd like to join the conversation, travel to our Discord channel at transmissionspodcast.com/discord. Want some cool Transmission swag? Feast your eyes on our Transmissions gear at transmissionspodcast.com/shop. If you'd like to support our podcast, go to transmissionspodcast.com/support or tell your friends about our show. We'll see you next time.